I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me here. It's good to be in Toronto again. So I'm going to talk about some instability results for the nonlinear Schrödinger equation with a periodic potential. This is joint work with Jared Bronski, who's also in Illinois. Okay, so we are considering the one-dimensional Schrödinger equation with both focusing and defocusing nonlinearity and a periodic potential. We assume that the period is just one. And we will be considering instabilities of standing wave solutions, which means solutions that have this form here. And for some of our results, we will have to assume that these standing waves bifurcate from the Floquet-Bloch eigenfunctions of the linear problem. And the kind of instability that we will be considering is modulational instability, which means that I have the standing wave solution, I add a perturbation to it, I want to see what happens to the amplitude of that perturbation. And in the case of a modulational instability, it gets exponentially amplified. I didn't know I could produce music. Who took, let's say, advantage of the Hamiltonian structure of the problem to produce some nice results. And recently, one of the organizers, Pelinowski and collaborators, considered bifurcations and stability of gap solitons. And this is, I think, the closest work to what we are doing. Since I already told you that we will exploit the Hamiltonian structure of the problem, let me review some results from Hamiltonian Floquet theory. The linearized problem is going to have this form. So this is going to be a vector, a four-dimensional vector. This Q-symmetric matrix here, it's a symplectic matrix in R4. H is periodic and symmetric, and we assume that the initial conditions satisfy this equality there. So the main quantity, let me put it in this way, in the case of Hamiltonian Floquet theory is the monodromy matrix, which is the fundamental matrix solution evaluated at one period. The eigenvalues of that matrix gives us information about the stability. Based on the structure, on the Hamiltonian structure of the problem, one can prove that the matrix is symplectic, which means that it satisfies this equality there. And that has a very nice consequence in terms of its characteristic polynomial. So you can prove by using the symplectic result here that the characteristic polynomial is palindromic, which means that it has this nice property here. And that in turn allows you to factor the characteristic polynomial in this way, which allows you to talk about its eigenvalues more easily. The k plus and minus here are what I'm going to refer to as locate discriminants. And these are the main objects that I'm going to study here. Now, if you want some intuition why we study those, let's go to the case where we have the linear Schrodinger equation, which means that our monodromy matrix is a 2x2 matrix. Then the main ingredient that tells us what happens to the eigenvalues is the trace of that monodromy matrix. So in the 4x4 case, the trace is replaced by this locate determinant. These are the things, the quantities that are going to tell us what happened to the eigenvalues. Mu is going to be my eigenvalue parameter. Yeah, mu is going to be my eigenvalue parameter. I'm going to get there. Let's ignore this. Sorry about that. I shouldn't have put it there. Okay, so I'm giving out information already. So what we know is that if the Floquet discriminants are inside this interval here, then all my eigenvalues lie in the unit circle. And based on the nice structure of the problem, I can express those in terms of the invariance of the monodromy matrix M. And I get this expression here. Now, eigenvalues can leave the unit circle only via collision. This is a result by Krein and collaborators. And if you want more details, you can go to the book by Jakubowicz and Sarzynski. Yes, I could have put here a closed interval. On the circle. Yeah, that's important. They have to be on the circle. The way in which I can determine what happens to the eigenvalues, what kind of collisions are good ones and what kind of collisions are bad ones, and by good and bad I mean when can the two eigenvalues just go through and still stay on the circle after the collision, on where after they collide they move the circle and one is outside and the other is outside, then in order to determine that I have to calculate the Krein signature. And the result by Krein says that the eigenspaces, that if the eigenspaces of my eigenvalue that who is on the unit circle have definite Krein signature, then I know that the symplectic matrix is stable, which means that if I perturb it a bit, the number of eigenvalues on the circle is unchanged. And this result is tight, which means that if the corresponding eigenspaces have indefinite Krein signature, then under a generic perturbation of that matrix, I have to expect that some of the lambdas leave the unit circle. Okay, let me show you a picture that shows what can happen. So this is an example of a good and a bad collision. That's a nice one. It means I have definite the sign of the Krein signature. So they collide and then they remain there while for a bad one, this happens. And the Krein signature is defined as an inner product where I take one vector from the eigenspace, I multiply it by J times M, and then I take the inner product of the... Yeah, that's a good idea. So this is the symplectic matrix that I used in the beginning. This is my monodromy matrix. I assume that the psi is in the eigenspace of an eigenvalue on the unit circle. So the Klein signature can be described by this. But this is not what we did. We realized that we don't have to really calculate all those Klein signs if we exploit the structure of the problem. So in our case, what we did is we calculated a new quantity, sigma of mu, which is defined as the trace of J times M of mu. And this quantity plays the role of the Klein signature. Now, let me tell you what the mu's are and how I got it. So I consider Hill's equation, and M is the monodromy matrix corresponding to this equation, and J is this skew symmetric matrix here. Then, for a sigma of mu defined in this way, we were able to prove three nice properties. One is that sigma of mu is non-zero in the interior of a band. And let me remind you what an earlier speaker said about the band gap structure. So this morning, we know that I have bands and gaps. So what I'm in the spectrum of the Hill's equation, this is my mu, which means that if my mu is inside a band, then sigma is non-zero. And the only and I know that it can vanish only if I am at a band edge, which means I am here or here. And the other thing that I can prove is that the sign of sigma is opposite to the sign of the trace of the derivative of the monodromy matrix with respect to the eigenvalue parameter mu. The calculation relies heavily on the definitions of these properties, and it's straightforward. It's a bit long, but straightforward. Okay. So, let's see. So, the reason why I made this review about Hamiltonian Floquet structure and about the Hill's equation is because if I linearize my problem around the standing wave solution that I showed to you in the beginning, then the problem that I get is this one. I guess I'm missing a sign here somewhere. I cannot have both glasses there. So this is the eigenvalue problem that I have, where the operators L plus and L minus have this form. And what I know about this eigenvalue problem is that mu equals zero is a periodic or anti-periodic eigenvalue, and that comes from the fact that the NLS equation is phase invariant, so I can use another theory, and I call it periodic or anti-periodic based on the fact that in some cases I assume that the standing wave solution bifurcates from a periodic Floquet Bloch eigenfunction, and in others it bifurcates from an anti-periodic eigenfunction. The other result that I can show is that the K plus the Floquet discriminants are analyzing in mu, unless this condition is satisfied. And this comes from the fact that if you recall the original expression for the Floquet discriminant, they had a branch singularity. So if I move away from there, from the square root, then nothing bad happened, so they're analytic. Okay. Okay, before I continue, let me tell you that what we did here is we took the the Fourier transform. So modulation and stability corresponds to mu leaving off of the real line. So if mu becomes imaginary, then I have modulation and stability. And I know that mu is in the spectrum of my problem if all the eigenvalues are on the unit circle. So if I'm able to prove that the eigenvalues can be on the unit circle for a mu imaginary, then I have an instability, a modulation instability result. And the first lemma that's going to get me to the proof is the one that tells me what happens if I move a bit away from the for mu equals zero. So if I know that zero is not a periodic eigenvalue of the L plus operator, then both Fourier discriminants are analytic in a neighborhood of mu equals zero. The proof comes from the fact that the monodromy matrix for the 4x4 problem decouples like this, where M minus and M plus are the corresponding monodromy matrix for the L plus minus operators. Now, this assumption that zero is not a periodic eigenvalue for L plus tells me that the trace of M plus cannot be zero. And also, for 2x2 matrices, one can easily prove by linear algebra this equation here. So in order for the Floquet discriminant not to be analytic, this has to be zero. But given the decoupling here and using this equation, I can prove that this equals trace of M plus minus 2 squared, but that cannot be zero, so I get analyticity here. And now I'm able, armed with this result, I'm able to give you a sufficient condition for instability, which is that mu equals zero is not in the interior of a band for the L plus operator. To do that, I'm using the previous lemma, which tells me that these are analytic. And I know from the form of the problem that if I use this transformation here, if I go from mu to minus mu, then all the matrix coefficients are invariant, which in turn forces the Floquet discriminant to be real on some part of the imaginary axis containing the origin. But this in turn tells me that the fact that I am in this case tells me that K plus is inside this interval here, and so from analyticity I get that K plus of mu has to be in that interval too. So this tells me that the eigenvalues stay on the circle, and for that part, and since this is true for a mu imaginary, I have modulation and stability. Now, this does not depend on how big or small epsilon is. That's a generic result. While the next one, which tells me gives me more information about what happens to the solution as they bifurcate from the band edges, depends. For that result, I need epsilon to be small. So let's consider now the case of weak nonlinearity. What we were able to prove is that if epsilon is positive and small, and if I have solutions that bifurcate from the lower band edge, which is not, I assume that it is not a double point, or if I have epsilon less than zero and small, but this time the solutions bifurcate from an upper band edge, which again I assume not to be a double point, then I can prove that there exists modulation and instability. And that's not something new for physicists, because for a long time they have been using what they call the effective mass and the sign of the effective mass, which is the inverse of the curvature of a dispersion of the dispersion relation, to study the dynamics of the Schrödinger equation in a potential. So what we're doing here is we're verifying what they knew already. For the proof, I'm going to need the first theorem, and I will have to do a perturbation in epsilon. So one can prove that in a neighborhood of epsilon equals zero and mu equals zero, K plus has this normal form, where this depends, of course, on epsilon and sigma and mu, and the F1 here is gonna be the periodic or anti-periodic solution of the Floquet the Floquet periodic or anti-periodic solution for the linear problem. And we ignore higher orders here in terms of epsilon and mu. And the k is the little k here, is the Floquet discriminant corresponding to the L minus eigenvalue when epsilon equals zero. So this normal form tells me that if I plug in mu equals zero, then this is what I get. And for the other Floquet discriminant, I know that it is zero because I assume that I am bifurcating from actually it has to be plus or minus, because I'm bifurcating either from the periodic or the anti-periodic eigenfunction. So what we can say after that is the following. If I consider the odd numbered band edges, then the lower band edge is where the periodic eigenvalue is, and for that I know that sigma is greater than zero. That comes from the fact that sigma has the opposite side than the derivative of the trace of the monodromy matrix, which is negative. So if in addition I have that epsilon is less than zero, then the k plus of mu for some mu along the imaginary axis remains in this interval. And on the other hand, if I consider the even numbered bands, then the upper band edge is the one which is the periodic eigenvalue, and in this case the sigma becomes negative. So for epsilon greater than zero, I get that k plus is inside this interval. And similar results hold for anti-periodic eigenvalues. Just reverse the sign above. Do I have some time? Okay. So, just two remarks and I'll finish. As I said before, the second theorem has a very nice physical interpretation in terms of the effective mass. And the other thing that I wanted to say is that we also consider some cases where mu is not zero. But for that case, we assume that k plus equals k minus, and this is something that we call an accidental degeneracy. And because of the fewer symmetries that exist here, our results are less complete. We had to make several assumptions, and still there are some things that we cannot calculate. So that's it.